Council, you may begin when ready.
Yes.
And you have 15 minutes. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Three, if I may.
Three. Yeah. 3 minutes it is.
Okay, thank you. And if it may please the court, Patricia Hart for...
Could you speak up just
yes.
a little bit? My ears are aging.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Patricia Hart for the appellant, Kenneth Merchant.
Better. Oh, much better.
Okay, sorry. May it please the court. Thank you. We're here today regarding the admission by the child court of testimony by two witnesses regarding prior unadjudicated bad acts during his sentencing hearing after a guilty plea. And not to reiterate the procedural history, but it is important to probably remind the court that this was a sentencing hearing after a motion in limine was requested by appellant prior to the sentencing to have it heard before a different judge to exclude the witness testimony that we thought was prejudicial, that would be prejudicial during the sentencing of Mr. Merchant. And it's appellant's contention that admitting the evidence by the trial court was under the an error of law, which was ipso facto abuse of discretion. In that, two witnesses, Adriana Chica, her mother, testified as to what the prior unadjudicated bad acts alleged of Mr. Merchant were, and Ms. Crone herself testified as to prior unadjudicated bad acts of Mr. Merchant. When this case came before the sentencing judge, the sentencing judge of the trial court decided that it would hear preliminary evidence in order to actually determine whether the evidence should be admissible, which included a substantial portion of the transcript when the trial court decided at one point that it would admit the evidence of the two witnesses testifying. Within the sentencing hearing, appellant argued that the standard of some indicia of reliability, which we read in Moses, which requires corroboration and particularization on the part of the evidence in order to be admissible, was not met. And in the case of Adriana Chica, which was testified to by her mother, and our contention was that it was hearsay, that it did not meet that standard of reliability and that it was not sufficiently corroborated under any particularity as stated in the Moses case.
What about the defendant's letters?
Yes, the letters, and I knew that the letters would come up because the trial court also stated that the evidence was corroborated in the letters, the pre-sentence report, and the psychosexual. Appellant contends, just to go down the list, that the pre-sentence report, there was actually nothing in there. The letters, in all fairness, had absolutely no admission of an actual act. They had apologies in them. They were...
Couldn't the fact finder, or in this case the sentencing judge, but I guess we're finding at least sentencing facts here, have read those letters and reached a conclusion about what he was apologizing for? It certainly seems to be a lurid act of some kind given his actual words.
Well, and that's where appellant would disagree, with all due respect, in that such evidence of, I would suggest, so vile and should meet a standard of reliability because it can be so harmful with being evidence against a child, Your Honor, that the conclusion met seemingly would be presumptuous considering the corroboration and particularity required by Moses. And that
Go ahead, please.
And that presumptions without significant corroboration isn't enough.
Is the standard significant corroboration? What is the standard?
The standard is set out in Moses, which is some indicia of reliability.
So that does not, some indicia of reliability does not suggest a very high bar, does it?
I would agree with you, but it was elaborated on in Moses that the evidence in that case was found to be sufficiently reliable due to the fact that it was corroborated from other sources with particularity. And that is seemingly the most important part of the standard because the indicia of reliability would seem to be such a low bar. However,
so you're relying on the with particularity.
And the corroboration, correct. Of which the trial court judge, in our opinion, mistakenly found that in the letters PSR and psychosexual that corroboration existed, that this would just be repeat evidence and therefore would not be was not only corroborated with particularity, but therefore would not be harmful in any more to the appellant than as if the even if the witnesses testified. And appellant's contention was, just to clear up the psychosexual because I didn't go over that, there was an admission to a past charge which he was convicted of aggravated sexual battery in 1987, which he fully admits. And although it's not pretty, he also admits to molesting his niece. However, these two specific witnesses, Ms. Crone and Adriana Cheeker, were never admitted in those two documents. And we have left the letters. Was that admission enough for the court to admit the testimony of two other witnesses that are not the victims or mentioned in those letters? Those letters, one was Adriana, but the other one, Ms. Crone, was not. This was an alleged victim,
but
not charged.
But Ms. Crone testified.
She did testify.
And was subject to cross-examination, which is the best indicia of reliability that the law has ever discovered.
Correct. And during that cross-examination of this alleged incident over 33, 34 years ago, she testified that she was in and out of twilight sleep.
Well, that was before the trier of fact, though.
Yes, Your Honor. However, our contention is that was not reliable enough information to have passed the bar of the first initial step of the trial court determining whether or not the evidence would be admissible, much like as if we had gone to a motion in limine and brought this issue up that shouldn't be heard during sentencing because of its prejudicial effect on
You earlier characterized the letters as not actually admitting to any offense.
I did.
And in one of the letters, he notes that he wasn't strong enough to resist his urges, and then says, and I'm quoting him, "Hate because I took a child's innocent love and twisted it into an adult love, destroying another family. I know that Adri is strong. I do hope she decides to get some professional help."
And
twisting a child's innocent love into an adult love, if that's not reference to some sort of sexual act, what could it possibly be?
Your Honor, and with all due respect, the alleged victim, Adri, was living with the appellant at one point in time, and he was in somewhat of a parental role. I, in all fairness, without specific words of what was done, he could have had any control. He placed rules in his house.
But hold on, taking a mm-hmm. child and committing against them, his word, an act of adult love, if not sexual, what's the difference between children's love and adult love if sex isn't the distinction?
Well, Your Honor, that begs the question of how far do we go in order to accept what I would call non-committed evidence
This is effectively a confession. He doesn't dispute he wrote the letter. He doesn't dispute that these are his actual words. I'm just asking you,
right,
if it doesn't mean that, what could it possibly mean?
And that's the exact problem. If we're guessing at what it could possibly mean without actually the words actually saying it, it's appellant's contention that with such highly prejudicial evidence that the standard should be higher.
I guess mm-hmm. I'm not making myself clear.
Right.
I think it means that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm giving you the opportunity to come up with some alternative explanation that may convince me that it doesn't mean that. I'm telling you, I don't see anything else it could possibly mean.
Well, Your Honor, like I had mentioned before, with his parental role of these children in his house, he had the ability to make rules and
make rules about adult love?
Well, Your Honor, I think that they considered him more of a grandfatherly role. I don't think that adult love in this case unless it's spelled out by the appellant what acts he was actually doing, I don't think that it
Well,
actually
don't we have the record to show us a prior incident, incidents.
Prior similar incidents, meaning the current victim of the sentencing hearing, yes.
Of the appellant.
We only have a prior incident in 1987. He had a conviction. The current victim of the actual charge in this case,
my point is, isn't the adult law to be considered in light of his prior history?
We would argue that that's a presumption, and it's a large presumption to make when...
It's just a matter that informs us to try to figure out what those words adult law might mean.
Well, in this case, we did not actually have the defendant get up and testify about it, so I can't speak for him, but what I can say is that we are relying on the fact that the actual factual circumstances omitted from the record, and when such prejudicial evidence is offered at sentencing against the defendant at the time, that it's so prejudicial that our point is that it should meet the standard of corroborated in particular.
His conviction is going to be prejudicial. The law says it has to be unduly prejudicial.
And that is exactly, in this case, there is no more evidence that's more unduly prejudicial than the molestation of a child.
No, it's not unduly prejudicial. It's the offense. All good evidence is prejudicial, as Judge Felton said. How about another one of his letters quoting him, and I don't see how his own words can ever be unduly prejudicial. He said it. I deserve to spend the rest of my life in jail. I will take what is coming because I deserve it. In the context of having been convicted of child molestation and pending sentencing for child molestation, writing a letter to somebody who there is other evidence claims to have been a past victim, writing a letter of apology and saying that, how does that not lead to the conclusion that, once again, he's engaging in improper sexual acts with a child?
But, Your Honor, I would still argue that that's circumstantial. And when we're talking about...
Circumstantial evidence is admitted and can prove stuff all the time.
I understand that. But in the context of this of the sentencing under Moses, the cooperation required and with particularity, it's the particularity that we're relying on that butts up against the unduly prejudicial.
Okay. Well, let me jump you to another piece of this. Crone's testimony. Mm-hmm. It's not hearsay, right?
No, it's not.
Okay. All right. That's aside. So now we look at Chica, right?
Yeah. The mother?
The mother.
Or the daughter?
Okay. The mother. I'm sorry. Explain how her testimony, the mother's testimony, is hearsay that doesn't fall under any exception.
Well, and we're still bringing it back to the Moses case. During sentencing, in the Moses case, it was the same situation that an officer was testifying as to what a confidential informant did was a prior bad act that the Commonwealth was trying to admit, and the confidential informant was not present. However, the court decided that there was sufficient corroboration with particularity and that the evidence was entered. In that case, unlike the case of the hearsay with Miss Adriana's mom, Chica, that was sufficiently corroborated because the officer was part of it. During the part that he didn't see with the confidential informant, there was actually a video made of it, and when he was done with the confidential informant, he actually retrieved the money, which sufficiently corroborated the act did happen that way from the... He took the money from the confidential informant.
Is it your position that the only sufficient corroboration would be a videotape?
No, not at all. I'm just pointing out that that was sufficiently corroborated with particularity. In the case of hearsay as far as Adriana Chica's mother, Miss Chica, it was just plain hearsay. It was corroborated by zero. It was not corroborated by the agent herself. With particularity, we would come back to with particularity. Were the letters particular enough in order to corroborate Ms. Chica's, meaning the mother's, testimony, which was hearsay, of what Adriana told her years ago after some time passed after a meeting with a psychologist? the question is how far away from reliability do you get when you have hearsay, uncorroborated? If we talk about the letters, then we go to how particular are the letters in order to meet the standard of sufficient reliability to be entered into evidence. And it's our contention that that was hearsay that did not meet the standard in order to be admissible under Moses.
Thank you, counsel.
Yeah, I see the time.
Your time is up, but we've asked you a lot of questions, so yes. We'll give you a minute on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson. You're on deck, okay. Sir.
Hopefully y'all be able to hear my voice. That's usually not an issue. Good morning.
But be careful not to hit that thing that has the green light.
Oh, this?
There you go.
Oh, you. This one's better?
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning.
Sorry, our technology leaves a little bit to be.
Well, as a very high-tech person, I always have very demanding expectations in this regard. Good morning, may it please the court. Let me just point out a couple of things at the very outset. One, just to confirm what's apparent, the convictions in this case are not at issue, purely. The one and only issue is the sentence and whether somehow a new sentencing hearing is necessary. Second, counsel spent, 15 minutes, however long she was up there, and did not say a word about the initial argument of the Commonwealth on brief, which echoes the point of the single judge in turning down this appeal initially, which is that any claim that the trial court found sufficient corroboration from the defendant's statements and the record in its entirety to demonstrate the reliability of these two witnesses' accounts was not made at trial and therefore is defaulted under Rule 5A18. As I said on brief, the argument at trial basically went to the claimed intrinsic unreliability of these two witnesses' accounts, such as one witness, it was hearsay, and the other was a long time ago, and she was asleep when it started. But there was nothing at trial as per essentially the main argument today, which is that there was not really adequate corroboration from the defendant's many statements and the other items in the record. So I think the single judge was right. I think the claim is defaulted under Rule 5A18 because the specific basis for the trial court's ruling was not challenged. It wasn't challenged here today. The only reference, by the way, to this whole subject was not in the petition for appeal. It was It was not in the opening brief after the single judge had explicitly based his rejection of this claim on a default under 5A18. It was only in the, not the argument part, but the conclusion. There was this brief reference, well, if the court finds it defaulted, then we rely on ends of justice exception in Rule 5A18. I think that's too little too late. I've cited cases where you can't make arguments in an opening brief, not in the petition for appeal. And then I think I cited one where it was said an oral argument, and that was for the first time. That was held to be too late. If that was incorrect, you could have a case where both this court and the Supreme Court consistently held a claim defaulted and there was no challenge to it, and then they file a petition for a hearing from the Supreme Court's rejection of the appeal, and for the first time cite ends of justice, and then that's held not to be untimely. So I submit the single judge is right, and it's defaulted. But let me move on to the merits. The basic thrust of the defendant's argument is that oblique but unmistakable admissions are not good enough. And particularly on appeal, that is just wholly misplaced. If that were true, then on appeal, the Commonwealth or the appellee could not prevail on tacit but nevertheless unmistakable findings of fact. Tacit findings of fact have every bit as much currency on appeal as explicit findings of fact. If that weren't true, you would probably have any number of criminal defendants in Virginia that would not be incarcerated at this time. You probably would have several Virginia death row inmates that wouldn't have been executed. There's no question that tacit findings of fact are sufficient. That seems to me irreconcilable with the argument of the defendant that we've heard today. Judge Russell has quoted language. I think it speaks for itself. But it's not just letters that he, Merchant, wrote after he'd been convicted pursuant to his guilty plea on these sexual offenses against this little girl. In fact, the letters to Ms. Chica and her daughters, which went to them even after they'd moved out of the Tidewater area, were in several instances written after his arrest but before he came to trial. He wasn't arrested on embezzlement. He wasn't arrested for larceny by false pretenses or a bad check. He was arrested on the sexual crimes for which he ended up pleading guilty and being convicted. And for him to write these letters at that time, all but saying, "I did these terrible sexual crimes to these little girls," speaks for itself. It wasn't, again, it was pre-trial as well as post-trial. Although I don't, you know, either way, it's, the Commonwealth is probably equally benefited, but particularly the post-arrest ones, I think that is very damning as to this defendant.
Mr. Anderson, talk a little bit about how the testimony is corroborated in its particulars.
Well,
and what that means.
Well, I think, as Your Honor's question indicated, I think it's a fairly low bar. I think in each of these instances, and it's interesting, this is not a signature crime case, but in some elements, it's almost what we're talking about. In each case, you have this defendant committing these sexual crimes against young girls when they're asleep, and in the case of Chica and in the case of the present crimes for which he pled guilty, there's one common denominator, a woman named Kate Grantham, who is the defendant's girlfriend, who in effect was his, I'm not saying anything about her having any knowledge, I don't know one way or the other, but in effect she was his entree to these little girls, because either he lived next door or he was there visiting her. She was the live-in babysitter. So I think that is a striking fact that in two of the three instances you have the same woman slash girlfriend of the defendant playing a central role in his access to the girls. You have girls of a similar age. You have, in each instance, they're asleep. The little girl that was the victim of the current crimes apparently never even woke up when he was doing the sordid things to her that he did. And so Crone, what happened to her was factually similar. And I think, if I remember correctly, Chica indicated that her daughter had a similar offenses committed against her. I think that is something quite significant, but I think it is sufficient for purposes of showing this some modicum of reliability that this defendant, in so many words, unmistakably acknowledged many times, many places, under many circumstances, in plain English, "I have a long history of sexually molesting young girls." I think that surely is sufficient to provide any corroboration required for the firsthand account of Crone, who again, is, I think, came up earlier today. No hearsay issues to her. She said, "This is what happened to me." She reported.
Isn't her testimony in subjecting herself to cross-examination sufficient indicia of reliability?
Well, I would submit it is, but if it isn't, it's mighty close, and we certainly have enough to put you over the requisite point of corroboration. She told her sister, she later told her parents, she moved back to the, she later filed a report, she moved back to the area in the late 90s, and her husband was apparently doing some house scouting, and she looked up and saw this man's name in the phone book, said, "I don't want you going anywhere near X neighborhood." And in the case of Chica, which admittedly is her reporting what her daughter said, although to a counselor. In that case, the report was made very quickly after the fact, so there's no issue of delay there. But whatever corroboration that may have been required, I think, was provided in spades by the defendant's own words. He was in the psychosexual report. I just don't see the particular utility of going through the two or three pages in my brief where I quote in some detail.
No, we don't need it. Go ahead.
I could go through the highlights of what I regard as the top points in those two or three pages.
We've seen your top 10 list.
Okay, thank you.
We're good.
Well, I had a couple of that were in consideration, but I'll
Well, if you want to get some of the highlights, that's okay.
I think that the rest of the record speaks for itself. There's no question that this man had a long history of sexual molestation of young children. And he apparently had a pattern. Certainly a pattern is suggested by what he did in the present case, as well as what he did to Crone and to Chica. Whatever level of corroboration was required, I submit, was amply provided. I would finally just submit very quickly that any claimed error under the non-constitutional error standard, which is the only one cited in this case, that's what we have here. The Commonwealth sought the maximum of, I think, two life sentences, 110 years. He got an active sentence of 26 years. The judge's sentencing remarks said very little one way or the other about the testimony of these two women. Had much more to do with what the record otherwise showed. So unless there are any other questions, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've got 2 minutes, and we'd like you to address the 5A18 issue.
Yes, I will. In first addressing how this came about with a previous motion in limine, I wasn't sure if I should address that, but I will address it now. First of all, this started with a motion in limine that was rejected by a judge, so that our idea was that it should be heard by a separate judge, so it didn't have a prejudicial effect on the sentencing judge. However, it was returned to the sentencing judge to be heard by him and the appellant to be sentenced by him. At that point in time, we filed a motion to exclude the witness testimony. In our objection to their testimony, we began the entire, and this is in the transcript, we began the entire sentencing hearing with, what is it that you object to, Ms. Hart? I object to the testimony of the two witnesses. The judge then determined that he should hear a bit of a portion of these witness testimony before he made the decision to actually enter it, include it, or exclude it. After several hours of testimony, I recall coming back from lunch, actually, counsel asked the judge to make an actual ruling on this decision. What is the ruling, Your Honor? I think it's around page 130, and I would have to look at the page.
That's okay, counsel.
What is your ruling regarding the admissibility of the two witnesses' evidence? He stated that I believe that there's sufficient corroboration in the record and that there are similar circumstances that exist in the appellant's history. Therefore, he's repeated it over and over again until he finally and definitively stated, I'm admitting the testimony of the witnesses after hearing the brief portion to determine whether he should hear the witnesses or not, at which point counsel duly objected, noted my objection, and renewed my objection.
What was the basis for the objection at that time? What was the stated basis?
That it was unduly prejudicial. The same exact reason that we had at the beginning.
But unduly prejudicial doesn't...
We then stated that it was we went through the Moses standard of it was not reliable, objected to it, and with some length in the record. And then the court went on to overrule the objection and admitted the witness testimony of these two witnesses. Therefore, appellant or counsel for the appellant believes that as far as Rule 5A18 is concerned, that it in invoking the ends of justice, that in fact it actually was objected to, was preserved, and the initial per curiam decision was incorrect.
Well, the question isn't was it objected to. The question is whether it was objected to for the reasons that you're arguing now.
It was objected to for the unreliability under Moses, mentioning Moses and Blunt for admission of the witness testimony. Yes, repeatedly.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
You're welcome.